Support for KQED Podcasts comes from Star One Credit Union, now offering real-time money movement with Instant Pay. Make transfers and payments instantly between financial institutions. Online or through Star One's mobile app. Star One Credit Union, in your best interest.
From KQED.
Hey everyone, from KQED Public Radio, this is Political Breakdown. Happy New Year! I'm Marisa Lagos.
And I'm Scott Schaefer, and today on The Breakdown, we're closing out the year by revisiting our recent conversation with one of California's newest mayors.
Oakland City Councilwoman Shang Tao is taking over the top job in the town. We talked with her about her family's journey from Laos and how she plans to tackle rising homelessness and violent crime. But first, Scott, let's look ahead a little bit. What are the top stories we're going to be watching in state politics next year?
Well, you know, it's funny. We were thinking, oh, there won't be any election until 2024. And then we started thinking, well, maybe the Senate race will be ramping up. And it already is. Dianne Feinstein, of course, although she hasn't said what her future plans are, I think everyone—
except for she said she will not retire early. We know
that.
She
will not retire early. She will be there to the bitter end. But I think Democrats are not going to wait for her to say she's not running. We've seen Adam Schiff gearing up, certainly. Katie Porter, perhaps. Ro Khanna, there's talk that he may run if he doesn't run for something else, like president. So there's going to be a lot of speculation. I mean, there's only so many people who can raise the kind of money and get the kind of organization you need to win in a state like California.
And that's the key here, right? I mean, the reason people are ramping up is, no disrespect to the current sitting senator, but it takes a long time to put together that kind of team to raise the money you need to, you know, play on TV. This is not a state. This is not Iowa. This is not a state fair retail politics place. You really got to work on name ID. And while Congress people like Adam Schiff and Katie Porter have some of that kind of sheen.
Not that much, really.
Exactly. You know? It doesn't mean everybody know. We know who they are.
Right.
And they are popular among very engaged Democratic base, but not necessarily everybody else. So an eye on that. But closer to home in Sacramento, we are expecting gas tax politics to really sort of be the name of the game when lawmakers and the governor return in January. This is a special session that was called by the governor in December, but didn't really happen. And yeah, we'll be watching to see. I mean, oil spent over $8 million this past election, mixed results for them. And it's going to be, I think, really interesting to see how this supermajority of Democrats yet again handles one of these issues that really does divide the Democratic Party.
It does. And there are some other bits of legislation that may come out as well. Phil Ting, assemblyman from San Francisco, is going to offer legislation during the special session that would kind of keep a closer eye and limit how many refineries can come offline at a given time, because that is part of what I think, whether half a dozen of them were offline at one point in 2022, and that certainly contributed to the lack of supply and drove up prices. So we'll see how that goes. It is, as you said, it's kind of a tough vote. It's not a tax; it's a penalty, but nonetheless, it could be a heavy lift. We'll see.
And we're going to see new chief of staff incoming for Gavin Newsom, Dana Williamson, who is a longtime top aide to former Governor Jerry Brown. She's going to be replacing Jim DeBoo. I mean, they're very close; they have pretty similar politics, DeBoo and Williamson. But personalities are always different. And I think it'll be interesting to see, you know, Dana, like her predecessor, has been around for quite a bit, has a lot of relationships in this legislature. And that's going to matter when we talk about things like not just oil, but the budget, the speakership, and housing. I mean, we're keeping an eye on this.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, earlier this year, the state announced that San Francisco was being investigated for the first city to be investigated in terms of its housing policy and how it approves housing projects.
It doesn't.
It takes very long time, much longer in San Francisco than almost any other place in the state. And so it'll be interesting to see if the governor's office decides to use some of that accountability authority that they have on other things. You know, could be homelessness, could be criminal justice. We'll have to wait and see. But
we've had some indications that they're kind of chomping at the bit.
Yeah, and you know, there's going to be less money to spend, so they can't keep throwing more money at some of these problems. They're going to have to make sure that the money they're spending is being spent well. And of course, that could create some friction between Sacramento and local governments.
Yeah. Another thing we'll keep an eye on. You mentioned the speakership. Anthony Rendon will be ending his term at the end of June. It's already been decided that Assemblymember Robert Rivas down from Salinas is going to be taking over. That was not a smooth transition of power. Rendon was not happy when Rivas presented him with the votes, but it is set now. And I think what's going to be fascinating is to see kind of how those two interact in the coming weeks and months, how the caucus reacts. There's a lot of sort of schisms within, and it's not all on moderate progressive lines this time. So that'll be fascinating.
Yeah, and interesting, too, that Rivas comes from the Central Coast, represents a more rural part of the state as well. But in the cities here in Alameda County, just across the bay, we have a new DA that got elected, Pamela Price, very progressive. And it's going to be very interesting to see just how she navigates the politics. We saw Chesa Boudin in San Francisco, ultimately recalled, but faced a lot of opposition from the police and law enforcement, the mayor. And, you know, Pamela Price has not really run a large organization before. It'll be interesting to see how that all plays out.
I think what I'll be watching with Price is sort of how she approaches it. Does she try to kind of be a little quieter, maybe a little less bombastic than somebody like Boudin or Gascon, who I think, you know, there's a number of reasons that those two things went differently, but the politics always matters. And of course, she's coming in alongside Chang Tao, who we're about to hear from, another progressive. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll revisit that conversation from earlier this month with Oakland's new mayor, Chang Tao. You're listening to Political Breakdown from KQED Public Radio.
Support for KQED Podcasts comes from Star One Credit Union, now offering real-time money movement with Instant Pay. Make transfers and payments instantly between financial institutions. Online or through Star One's mobile app. Star One Credit Union, in your best interest.
I'm Katia Adler, host of The Global Story. Over the last 25 years, I've covered conflicts in the Middle East, political and economic crises in Europe, drug cartels in Mexico. Now I'm covering the stories behind the news all over the world in conversation with those who break it. Join me Monday to Friday to find out what's happening, why, and what it all means. Follow The Global Story from the BBC wherever you listen to podcasts.
Welcome back to Political Breakdown. I'm Marisa Lagos here with Scott Schaefer, and we are thrilled to have Oakland City Councilwoman Chang Tao here. She was just elected as mayor, a job she'll take over next month. Chang Tao, welcome to the breakdown.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for coming in. Yeah, we're always excited these days to get guests in person. So we want to talk about all your plans for Oakland, but we would like to start with your very compelling life story. Your parents fled Laos as refugees. Tell us a little bit about before they came here and had 10 kids, what was their journey like to America?
Absolutely. So my parents, it wasn't a fairy tale love story or anything like that. It was during the Vietnam War. There was also a secret war, and there were a lot of bombs that, you know, the Hmong people, we live in the jungles and in the hills of Laos mainly, but also, you can also find Hmong people in the jungles and mountains of Vietnam and China as well. But because of that, you know, the Hmong people had to choose between joining forces with the American CIA or, you know, joining forces with the communist Viet Cong, and then not just that, but the Laos as well, too. And so many of the Hmongs actually chose to be part of the American CIA. And because of that, they helped a lot in regards to navigating the jungles for the Americans, and not just that, but really helping with those who were hurt on the ground. And my parents fled. I heard a lot of stories about how families fled, and when you had an infant or a younger child, they fed them little pieces of opium so they would go to sleep so they wouldn't be loud. Mm. Sometimes babies never woke up. Mm. And sometimes parents refused to leave their kids or give kids opium, and so they stayed behind. Just no one knows what happened to them. And so,
yeah. So yeah. They eventually settled in California. I think you grew up in Stockton, 10 children. As Marisa said, you were number seven,
yeah.
I think. You know, oftentimes we hear about refugees coming to this country, whether it's Vietnam or Cuba, and it really affects the way they look at the world and politics. And I'm wondering, how did that affect, you know, your worldview as a kid based on what they told you?
You know, I remember the day that my dad became a citizen, and he was able to vote. And he was just so excited to vote and be part of the political world here in the United States. And so politics is important to the Hmong community. It's about activation. They do believe in making sure that their voices are heard. But for me, how that shaped me is that it was really through, you know, we have our own politics within the Hmong clans as well. We have 18 clans. And so my dad being a leader in our Tao clan, it really shaped how I view politics, American politics. And the view was always around community, building community. If you build on community, then that's how you keep yourself safer. And not just that, but that's how you understand what resources are needed so that you can deliver on your promises. And so that's kind of the leadership that I lead with right now. Yeah.
But I understand you clashed with your parents and the expectations of traditional gender roles. Yes. In your family and culture. Can you talk about that? And like, how did that play out?
Yeah, so I've actually been really rebellious ever since I was at a young age. So yes, it's the patriarchy is real as it's real with many cultures. And they were wanting for the girls to wake up around 6 a.m. to cook and clean while the boys could do whatever they want. And my whole thing was, I'm not getting up out of my bed, even if I'm awake. If my brothers aren't getting up, I'm not. So I always joke around, but it's true that to this day, I'm not the best cook.
How did your parents like react to that?
They, you know, they're frustrated. You know, they tried everything from like, physically trying to get me up, hollering and yelling and whatever have you. But I was just very stubborn. So there was one point where my parents are like, all right, you're a lost cause.
I assume you have some sisters in that clan.
Yes,
as well.
I do.
How did they respond to your rebellion?
You know, I wasn't so close to my sister growing up, the age gap, but I just remember seeing my sisters. They were great listeners. They woke up and did what they needed to do. They hated it. They saw me as like just being rebellious and annoying, you know, because I was rebellious, I was putting my parents in bad moods, and that would then, you know, trickle out and affect all of my other siblings. And so, yeah.
Well, you moved out at a young age, right? Mm-hmm. At 17. Was that because of this tension? Tell us about that time in your life, because I know it was a challenging one as well.
It really was. You know, in hindsight, you know, going through all the trauma, my mom carries a bullet in her arm still from fleeing their secret war. My parents met in a refugee camp. And so, you know, seeing so much death in front of them, seeing all, you know, having all that trauma that has never been taken care of or no treatment. It was hard. You know, I was trying to be Hmong American when I went to school. And then when I got home, it was culturally just Hmong. And it was a clash of like, who am I? Who do I identify as? And my parents not understanding being the American part. And so because of that, we did clash a lot. There was some physical abuse. But in hindsight, you know, I do believe that they were doing the best they could.
So I'll go ahead, finish.
No, my baby sister, who was kind of like a mistake, right? No. No, my baby sister, she actually, I mean, they learned from parenting us and trying to force us into this box. They learned from all of that. And this is why I know that it was only the trauma, and they were trying to do the best they could. Mm. Because with my baby sister, they really did really well.
Interesting.
Yeah.
You really overcame a lot. You moved out of the house, as Marisa said, I think when you were 17. You got into a relationship. You had a baby. At one point, you were homeless, sleeping in your car, trying to get to school, go to school and college. I mean, what did you take from all that? And what gave you the fortitude to, you know, stick it out?
You know, it's not a unique story, you see. It's like many people, many families go through this. Right now, I feel like the majority of families are feeling housing insecure. But you go on survival mode, right? It's not a good place to be, you know, and that's a place where you need hope the most, right? You just need a second chance. And going and becoming, my first relationship being a domestic violence relationship, I was cut off from my friends, from my family. And, you know, it was a really bad time in my life. And it took, you know, me to 4 years and being pregnant at 6 months, you know, and he's still beating me, that I left. Not because, you know, like I was like, okay, I'm going to leave, even though I'm this strong, rebellious young girl. Because it's hard, because they make you feel as if no one's going to ever care for you or love you, right? And I was only 20 years old around that time. And so, but I left because I knew I did not want my son to grow up in that place. And because of, you know, I left, I didn't have anywhere to go and lived in my car, couch surf with strangers. You know, after giving birth, the nurses, they were terrific. They followed me wherever I was at. I don't know how they found out where I was at, but they would show up and teach me how to feed my son, bathe my son. I mean, nurses for me mean so much, even prior to the pandemic. They really saved my son and my life.
So when he was an infant, you were still homeless?
Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Still homeless, still couch surfing. I remember a time where it was cold, and so a friend connected me with their friend, and I slept, you know, I didn't sleep at all, actually. I had a knife under my pillow and was willing and ready to do whatever I needed to do to keep my baby safe. Luckily, I didn't have to do anything, but still, I didn't get any sleep that night.
You know, some people have... A lot of people, as you suggested, have really terrible personal stories. And sometimes people just don't want to talk about it. Mm-hmm. They don't, you know, they hide it, they bury it, whatever. You're very open about it. And has that worked for you?
Yeah, you
Seems
know.
Seems like it has.
Well, yeah. I mean, it is very hard to talk about, right? And so for many, many years, I hid that because I was embarrassed of it. I was ashamed of it. But what I found, the more that I talked about it, is that there are so many people who are actually going through these things. I mean, like, you'll have people who probably are in the professional world who come to me afterwards and say, hey, I'm going through it right now, right? It doesn't matter what your socioeconomic status is. It doesn't matter what culture you come from, ethnic group you're from. Like, people are suffering through it. And so for me, it's actually been very healing for me personally. And then not just that, the knowing that it's going to actually help someone else, like, look, there's a light at the end of the tunnel, you know? And so it's been really healing.
You are listening to Political Breakdown from KQED Public Radio. I'm Marisa Lagos here with Scott Schaefer. Our guest today is Oakland Mayor-elect Sheng Tao. All right, well, let's talk about how you ended up going from being homeless with an infant, which is just, I can't even imagine, to you enrolled at Merritt College. You got, I think, your AA there. You transferred to UC Berkeley, graduated valedictorian. But I think you were still struggling because I read somewhere that you applied for an internship with Councilwoman Rebecca Kaplan in Oakland, in part because it paid well.
Yeah. Well, yeah. So through the program called APAPA, it is a program that really tried to get APIs into local government. I was actually on my way to law school. I couldn't afford to pay for my son's coats because he was outgrowing it so quickly. As parents, we all know that.
I hear that.
And so this program was pairing people up with local government and paying them $1,000 for that summer. So I admit I took it because of the money. And I got paired up with Vice Mayor Kaplan in Oakland City Hall, and that was when, like, my whole world changed. I finally realized, because you learn about local government probably, like, I don't know, a semester in public school, and so you don't really get the grasp of how important local government is. And so when I was there as an intern, I saw the legislator creating policies that truly was actually creating these negative consequences or unintended consequences for those families that live on the margins, families like mine. And I just thought that was crazy that no one with lived life experience was actually sitting in those seats.
What made you decide to run yourself? Was there a moment, or did somebody encourage you, Rebecca Kaplan or somebody else?
So when I ran for my city council seat, it was a lot of community who really pushed me to really run for that seat. And I'll be very honest with you. My response was, well, I don't come from money, and I don't look like how politicians look. So, and I don't talk like them. I don't think that's not me. And so, but it took for community to really allow me to see that, you know, that's why I was needed, right? And that they would help and support. And so that's, you know, and then I threw my name in the hat, you know, saying like, okay, well, you know, if you're willing to support me and if you feel like I can be best fit in this position, then I will try it. Still not being too sure that I would fit what a politician looks like. And now I have grown into this politician role, and it's not about a look at all. The problem was that we didn't have enough people with my lived life experience that look like me or what have you in these positions, and it's important to make sure that we have that diversity.
Well, you served a term and then partway through threw your hat into the ring for mayor. And I would say, like, watching this from across the bay, you were really seen as the progressive candidate in this race. You got a lot of labor support. What does that title mean to you? And what do you think it means to the people who supported you as you enter this office?
Yeah, you know, I am a progressive. And I think that over the many years, like somehow being a progressive is has been looked down kind of on just because of what people are ascribing to it. But I am a progressive in the sense that I want to move the city forward for working families, right? And I do believe that if we support those who are on the margins, that we all can have a better quality of life. So lifting from the bottom up.
What does that mean in terms of policies?
Mm-hmm. So what does that mean in regards to policy is renter protections, right? So I'm a strong advocate of passing strong renter protections, not just that, but ensuring that, you know, renters can have access and pathways to home ownership. We know that's intergenerational wealth, right? So taking down some of those barriers. What that also looks like is that our school system, making sure that they are accessible and that they're doing their part in regards to delivering what our students needs. And so really looking at those who are most on the margins to see what resources they need, and then making sure that you are delivering those resources. So that, because again, I see all of this as an ecosystem. They're all interconnected. If our kids are safe and kept busy and money in their pockets, then we, for public safety, we would be better off for them.
You mentioned public safety. What about the OPD and obviously crime, violence, just public safety? You yourself had an incident at your home when your son was there alone. Somebody broke in, tried to rob. So how do you think about public safety in Oakland? And it's obviously...
And your relationship with the police.
Yeah, and your relationship with the police. And, you know, will you keep the police chief?
So I am going to keep the police chief. Chief Laurent Armstrong, I have a pretty strong relationship, even as a council president pro tem. I was able to really champion and author policies that we are seeing that are actually getting us to the numbers that we need to be at. We are funded for 752 officers. And for the first time ever, because of the policies that I offer, we're at 700 officers. For me, I think it's a comprehensive approach. You know, if you talk about public safety, you have to talk about investments directly to communities, right? Investment directly to our youth. And so I just came out of a meeting because where we talked about year-round youth paid jobs. That's also public safety, right? But the response to me is also incredibly important, being a victim of crime myself, where they broke into my home, saw my son. They didn't care. They just went forward. It was traumatizing for my son. He's 16 now, and he's still traumatized. So the response of feeling like government will respond to things that are traumatic like that is incredibly important to me as well. Mm-hmm.
Do you think that's kind of a new path for progressives? Because obviously there was a lot of backlash to the defund movement. And I think that a lot of what the left has wanted to see is sort of globally supported, except for if it's coming at the expense of response times and the visibility of police. Like, do you think you can thread that needle?
Absolutely. I mean, I've been doing that as a council member and as the CEO of our beautiful city of Oakland. I think I am in a position where I can bring people together. I do believe that businesses, our residents, our voters, they're tired of the infighting. They just want a leader who can work with the stakeholders and deliver the results that are needed, right? So that the quality of life, everyday quality of life, that it's uplifted for everyone.
You are going to be following Mayor Libby Schaaf, who's leaving. She did not endorse you. Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts of her mayoralty? What did she do right? What did she do wrong? And most importantly, what will you do differently?
Yeah, it's a hard question, right? Because until you're in the hot seat, you don't know all the nuances that goes on. And there are a lot of nuances. What I can say that I would do different is around our unhoused community. Being a single mom, I know that, I wouldn't feel comfortable if I went to a park and it was, you know, full of tents. And so for me, it's like we need to have dignified housing. We need to make sure that we are bringing the services to our unhoused. And that means opening up our public parcels and getting them off of our streets, out of the parks and onto these parcels with, pallet shelters, with electricity, bring them the services they need so that we can have a safe space for them. And then at the same time, we have to build. right? Affordable housing, deeply affordable housing, social housing, workforce housing, moderate rate housing, right? And so I'm a champion right now as a legislator for the EIFD, which is a way that we would be able to fund.
Which is say what? Yeah.
Yes, the Enhanced Infrastructure Financing
it's
District.
Kind of like redevelopment. Not
yes,
to
it
make
is.
It.
It is. I always say that it's the better version of redevelopment, right?
Why?
Because there's strong oversights, and not just that, but these are projects that are pipelined, and as the money come in, you already know which projects are going to be lined up next to actually be implemented.
But it's the same
right?
kind of financing mechanism,
yes.
right? That you're sort mm-hmm. of borrowing against future tax revenue in a specific area to help fund that.
Yes.
As Jerry Brown did until he took it away.
Yeah, Jerry Brown loved it until he eliminated it.
Yes.
Loved it as mayor, not so much as as governor. Well, that's a good lead into the Oakland A's, the $12 billion question, which is, I know you and most of the council are committed to keeping the A's in Oakland. You want this waterfront ballpark. And you've said you don't want to use public money. Mm-hmm. Is that a red line? Like, would you consider any general fund money? And what are the financing options if taxpayers don't step up?
Well, right now we have so many grant dollars that have already been secured at the Senate level, Assembly level. And so I am a huge proponent of moving forward with keeping the A's rooted here in Oakland. But again, it is a hard line in regards to taxpayers' dollars. I will not be okay with using taxpayers' dollars for building out of the stadium. You know, there's going to be grant funding that are already coming in and secured. Hopefully there'll be more secure grant funding in the future. And then not just that, but really, you know, I am hopeful that the A's will come to the table and keep an open mind.
You think they've been forthright with the city so far?
You know, I'm not going to I can't genuinely comment on that just because I haven't been in those negotiations, to be very, you know, transparent. I haven't been in those negotiations. However, you know, at the very beginning when we were negotiating through the media, I did not like that. I felt like the A's and the A's could have done a little bit better.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Won this election by like 700 votes. I know you know the exact number because I heard you say it on TV the other day, a little bit less than 700.
Yes. Now we have the final count. It's 677
okay.
votes.
So, you know, there was a lot initially, you know, you were behind and then with ranked choice voting, you caught up and ultimately went ahead. Do you, given that, do you feel, does that affect the way you think about reaching out to voters who didn't vote for you or for whom you weren't their first, second or third choice?
Absolutely. I mean, it shows that the city is, you know, divided in regards to how we're facing the different crises that we're going through. But for me, as mayor of the city of Oakland, I represent everyone. And it is going to be my responsibility to reach out to those who may have maybe put me as number 2, 3, 4, or 5, or maybe I didn't even land on their ballot. And I take that very seriously. So I, you know, it's about being in community. It's about having relaying to community what the plans are and how we gain a better, stronger quality of life. And that's truly what the call to action is, you know, our streets are the dirtiest it's ever been. Let's clean it up, right? Our unhoused community is out of control. Let's figure out the root causes for public safety. And so for me, it's about delivering on the promises that I made on my campaign, which is touches on all of these points. And I think through that, I'll be really representing the city of Oakland.
Mm-hmm. All right. We're short on time, but I am curious. You know, we talked about you having your first son while you were homeless. He's now a teenager watching his mom become mayor of the city you live in. What's his reaction been to all of this?
His first reaction is, Mom, can I go see the jail that's inside of City Hall now? the old jail. Yeah, there's an old jail in there. But no, he's so excited. And he's, you know, he tells me all the time that he's really proud of me.
Oh, that's nice. And not embarrassed, as a lot of teenage kids would be.
Yeah, I thought he would be embarrassed. But no, he says that he's really proud of me. I mean, him and I, we basically grew up together.
Yeah.
So he remembers when we were really, really poor and he couldn't have that toy to now it's like, I'm like, honey, you can spend a little bit of money.
Oh,
it's okay.
Nice.
Oh, yeah.
That's great. Thank you, Mayor Lex Shengtao. We
so
really
much.
Appreciate your time.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
That's going to do it for this edition of Political Breakdown. We're a production of KQED Public Radio. If you like what you heard today, subscribe to our podcast and our newsletter. You can find that online at kqed.org/newsletters.
Our engineer today is Jim Bennett and our producer is Guy Marzorati. I'm Scott Schaefer.
And I'm Marisa Lagos. Have a good one.
Do you love your local bookstore? Well, I have the perfect event for you. This Saturday, April 27th, is Independent Bookstore Day. It's a day to celebrate your favorite local bookstore. I'm Olivia Allen Price, host of the Bay Curious podcast here at KQED, and I'm popping in to let you know that we will be hosting an event at Green Apple Books in San Francisco for the occasion. Come out for an author Q&A about the Bay Curious book. We'll be playing some Bay Area-themed trivia. There will be prizes and so much more. And the best part, tickets are donation-based, and all proceeds go to the Prisoners Literature Project. Learn more at kqed.org/live. I hope to see you there.